This week on Art in the Air features jazz guitarist and educator Bill Boers, who's associate chair of the music department at Columbia College in Chicago, and jazz saxophonist, flautist, and music educator at Oakton College, Tim McNamara, who both have performed with a who's who of musical greats. Our spotlights in the fall events at Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, including their Halloween Bash with Julia Gibbs.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. And is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. I'd like to welcome to Art on the Air Spotlight, back again from the Miller Arts and Creative District. Julia Gibbs is the executive director, and she's going to tell us a little bit about what's going on there coming up this fall, starting in October. We just talked about Dance Off, which was the previous thing, and some of the other events on. Julia, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hi, Julia.
Hi, how are you? I'm really excited to be here again to talk about what we have going on in October. And the first event I wanted to bring up is one from our music series, our occasional music series called Live on Lake Street. We are welcoming the Surge Quartet to our stage on October 23rd. Now, they're a new improvisational group of internationally known musicians led by Fred Lundberg-Holm. And they'll be performing here, I think, for the first time as they travel across the United States. They're four really extraordinary musicians from the international improvisational scene. And they will be bringing their work to our stage. And I think it's a really exciting opportunity for people to come out and listen.
Is it indoor or outdoor?
It will be indoors.
Okay.
And again, for people who aren't quite familiar with this kind of music, this is an improvisational group. So when people come in to see the show, they're not necessarily coming in to listen to tunes or compositions per se, but to listen to the sort of sonic landscape that the musicians are creating on the spot. So each of them has a really distinctive voice. There's cello and violin and clarinet and saxophones, but each of the musicians is playing their music in a very untraditional way. So you really get these very beautiful expressive textures and sonic landscape happening through the performances. So I really encourage people to come out and try that out. It's $15 at the door or through our website, which is millerbeacharts.org. And again, that's October 23rd at 7:30 p.m.
Okay. Now you have something for Halloween coming up too, something that is an event that you have. Is that an annual event or is this the first time you're doing it?
It is an annual event. In fact, this is the third year we're going to be offering our Halloween Bash. It's become kind of a staple of our offerings because it's such a good time. It's a dance party, really, and a costume ball. People put a lot of creativity and effort into their costumes and come out for a great night of dancing. We have drinks and food from local restaurants and caterers. We have a costume contest, and it's really a good time. It helps us raise funds for our arts and wellness program, which includes our art workshops and our free community yoga program. So we really encourage people to come out for that as well. That one, again, it's $20 at the door or through our website. And it's on October 31st, Halloween night at 7 p.m.
And you have music for that event. Who supplies that?
We usually have a DJ.
A DJ?
And I think we'll probably do the same this year. Yeah, as well. And it really is fun. People put a lot of effort into their costumes, and it's amazing to see the range of really inventive things that people come up with to dress up with on that night.
Is there a contest, a costume contest?
Yeah, we have small prizes from around the neighborhood, you know, gift certificates and things like that. It's more of a fun evening than really anything grand. But yeah, I think people have a great time when they come out for it.
So going into November and December, what else do you have going on in the Miller Beach?
So we will probably welcome another performance from the Miller Community Theater. They're going to be doing a performance of Almost Maine, and that'll be coming up in November. I would ask people to check the dates through our website as we get closer to that time period. But then on December 5th, we also open our annual community art show, which is always a show. We do it every December and January of artists exclusively from the Gary area. It's always really wonderful because the creativity around this part of the world is astounding. I'm always amazed by how many people we have come out for it, how many artists are involved, the age range of the artists who are involved in that show. It can be anywhere from kids to seniors and everyone in between. And just the creative range of work that gets put on display. It's a really wonderful show.
And one thing about the community theater, is that open auditions? Do they post their auditions for that?
They do. Those will have happened at the very beginning of October. So by the time we're on air, they're going to be deep into into rehearsals. So I would invite people to come out. And if they're interested in learning more about the theater, they can certainly come to a performance, meet the director and the executive director, and find out more about how to audition for the next show in the winter.
Just crossing the line into 2026, anything happening just as a heads up there?
Wow. I'm sure we're going to have a lot going on. I don't think my brain can stretch that far at the moment. We always have an exhibit on display in the gallery. So we'll have more work coming up throughout the year, and always more plays, more music, a lot more people coming through the space.
Could you share the address?
We are at 540 South Lake Street in Miller Beach, Gary, Indiana.
Right. And there's a whole bunch of things happening in Miller Beach. It's really revitalized. Lots of restaurants and things going on there. So it's a whole different experience coming there and doing stuff. So why don't you quickly recap what you got coming up in October, November?
Again, in October on the 23rd, we've got Surge Quartets coming through with improvisational jazz. October 31st, the Halloween Bash. And then in December, the community show opens on December 5th.
That's fantastic. A lot of things happening. That's the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. Julia Gibbs is the executive director, and you can reach out there on their website and or Facebook page. Hey, thank you so much for coming back on Art in the Air Spotlight and sharing everything that's going on there.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Ember Forge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. This is Pledge Week for your public radio station, and Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program.
This is Howard Levy, musician, author, and educator, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Bill Boris to Art on the Air. Bill is a prolific jazz guitarist who performs throughout the Chicago area and has performed in jazz festivals throughout the world, as well as performing and recording with numerous renowned musicians. He debuted his first CD, Hold Back, in 1999, featuring original compositions. His CD, Bright Moments, was released in 2018. He is the coordinator of guitar and bass studies and associate chair of the music department at Columbia College, where he has been a jazz guitar instructor and ensemble director since 2001. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Bill. It's very wonderful meeting you.
It's great meeting you, Esther. It's my pleasure to be here, and I look forward to doing this.
Well, and our first question usually is we want to know about our guests, their background story. In other words, how they got from where they were to where they are now. So tell us all about Bill.
Well, I grew up in Munster, Indiana, until I was 11 and we moved. And I really liked listening to music on the radio as a kid. And my father kind of built these speakers that were really big and loud in our house. So I heard a lot of classical music. Mozart and Haydn, and at the same time hearing Harry Belafonte and mariachi music. And my dad actually met Marty Robbins, so I heard Marty Robbins a lot. Not Marty Robbins, Conway Twitty. So we heard Conway Twitty records a lot. And hearing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan kind of started everything rolling. And when I was in sixth grade, I started playing in a band. I got a guitar at Tops, the discount store on Indianapolis Boulevard, and started playing, and I loved it, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. When I was 11, we moved to Michigan City, and I went to junior high there, and then graduated from Elston in Michigan City. But throughout junior high and high school, I played in bands, rock bands, and we kind of focused on like Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. So the band had horns, and my best friend was a trumpet player, and we figured out all the songs and played at school dances. And I knew that's what I really wanted to do with my life. And later in high school, or sometime in high school, I listened to the radio station, might have been WVON, but it had all female disc jockeys, and they played all kinds of music, including Steely Dan, Stevie Wonder, Freddie Hubbard, George Benson. And so I got to hear all this music on one station. And when I heard George Benson play, that was it. This is what I have to do, I thought. And my parents did not want me to do that. So I did go to college. I went to Notre Dame, and I graduated from Notre Dame, but I also attended Berklee School of Music. And all through college, I played in college bands and groups off campus and studied and just kept performing and kept playing. And I mean, after college, I actually lived in Japan for a couple of years because I was there as an exchange student, thinking I could play jazz in Japan. It would be great. And it was, but I couldn't get a work visa to stay there playing music. So I came back.
How long were you there?
I was there 1 year as an exchange student and a year and a half or 2 years after I graduated from college. I went immediately back because jazz is really popular in Japan, and I lived in Tokyo. It's a really vibrant city. And
did any Japanese influences get incorporated into your jazz playing?
That's a really good question. And maybe subconsciously, just being there, I spoke Japanese, and it's rusty now, but maybe somehow in through the culture,
it right. Might have. It's such a beautiful, the music is so beautiful.
The music's beautiful. The instruments are really different and kind of soothing sounding. And while I was in Japan, I taught English, but I played with a lot of really great Japanese jazz musicians, and I also played with some really fantastic Brazilian musicians who would come to Japan for 6 months. Japan and Brazil have a strong relationship. So anyway, I loved it, but I came back after a couple of years.
I have a silly childhood question, actually. Do you remember the names of all your various bands?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say that somebody told me the name of a band I had when a band we had when I was in seventh or eighth grade, and that was called the Cast Iron Canaries. It's hard for me to even spit it out. Psychedelic times, and although I wasn't on drugs, none of us were, but that was kind of a going kind of trend to have weird names like that. And in high school, we were called the Spalding Hotel, which was named after a hotel in Michigan City.
Right.
And that was our Chicago-like band. And then I think after that, it would be, I think when I lived in South Bend for a number of years, maybe 4 or 5 years after I came back from Japan. And one of the bands we had was called Uptown. And then the other bands were kind of with artists' names, like singers' names and that sort of thing.
Now we have the Bill Boris Trio, right?
Now we have the Bill Boris Trio, and among other groups I play in.
So when you started recording your music, tell us a little bit about that process. And I know a little bit later we're going to listen to one of yours, but tell us about getting into the studio and actually capturing your music for its release.
So if I may, I'd like to go back to the actual first record I made in the 80s that was on cassette. And I gave one to Mary Lou Henner, which is kind of funny, outside of a restaurant when I just got my cassettes. But that process was like consumed probably a year of my life because I programmed everything. It was like a crossover record. So I did all the drums, all the piano, all the bass. And I was in the studio for off and on for a year. So that was one kind of recording process. So this last one, I kind of did in a day. I had worked with the great organist Charles Erlin, and we did two records. We rehearsed one day, and then did the record the next day. We did two records in 2 days. So I saw how he did it, and we actually did that. We rehearsed and went in and recorded for about 10 or 12 hours, and that was basically. Basically, there were some small fixes, and the mixing took a long time. But I had been playing at that time in a group for about 3 years with Tyrone Blair, who plays drums, and Dan Chase, who plays organ. We'd been playing, and I wanted to do something so I could have kind of documentation and also to try to get more work. And we went in and recorded it. In 1 day, I think we went in the day before to get sounds. And it was pretty exhausting, pretty tiring, but it was a great experience. And the sounds were good on the record. And the audio, the way they recorded it was pretty good.
I like hearing that because that's how we listen to music generally. We'll put on the album and listen to it, you know, an hour or however long it is. So it's kind of interesting that that's the way you performed it. You like going to a concert.
Like immediate, yeah, like a concert. And most of them were like first or second takes. And then, of course, stuff went wrong where there was a buzz or we had to start over for technical reasons. The part on that, again, took a long time was the mixing. And it came out. I liked the way it came out for the most part.
The long part was actually composing everything.
Right.
Time too, yeah.
What's that like for you?
Oh, the composing part?
Yeah, the composing part.
I'm kind of glad you asked because it's pretty, I don't want to say it's painful because that sounds dramatic, but it's not painful. It's just really intense and long. And you don't really want to, for me, I mean, I think I know when it's kind of right for me, somebody else might disagree. But that takes a really long time. It's kind of like writing a paper or an email or anything else that you want it to be as good as you can get it. And there's a bunch of choices you can make when you're writing or composing or arranging. And to kind of exhaust all the choices to make sure that that's the appropriate one at every turn, you know, in every part. So it doesn't, they don't just kind of come out, I mean, maybe little pieces, but it takes a long time. And then I guess once it's done and I don't think about it later. But that part takes a long time. I just don't sit down and do it once. In 20 minutes.
Well, we want to talk about something from your Bright Moments CD. We want to take a listen to it. How Can I Be Sure? Tell us a little bit about that, and then we'll take a listen to it.
So on my first kind of recording that I released, it was almost all original music. And on this one, I think there are five cover tunes and five of my songs. And on my during my performances, I try to play songs that people know, but also that I really like. And the song How Can I Be Sure by the Young Rascals really was, I really remember from growing up. And they played it a lot on the radio. And it's a really, it's a wonder, it's a beautiful song, and it's very unique. It's a lot different from other songs. And I thought it would make an interesting instrumental and try to arrange it in a modern sort of current way for a trio.
And this is your trio, correct?
This is my trio. Yes. And I have a trio now, and the we have a different keyboard player, Thomas Gunther, who's amazing. And people enjoy the group because they can relate to the music. And even when we play something that's like so-called straight ahead jazz, they like the interplay and the immediacy of what's happening and kind of be part of it. And they also, again, they relate to songs they know, and that helps kind of keep people interested.
Well, let's take a listen. This is Bill Boris and the Bill Boris Trio. Bright Moments is the CD. How Can I Be Sure? Inspired by the Young Rascals. Thank you. that was How Can I Be Sure with Bill Boris, Bright Moments CD, a wonderful rendition of that.
Yeah, that made me especially happy because Felix Cavallari was one of our beloved guests. He was just such a joy, and we love his music. So,
when did you speak with him?
Oh, probably last year.
He issued a whole new CD, which was sort of a rebake of some of the ones they did, and then he had some new material that they were doing. So,
I was in New York. Getting ready to do a show called Beehive that was going to go to Japan, yet for a different to Japan. And we were in a studio because there were friends of mine, another short story. I lived in Florida for a while and toured as part of a rock band that backed up 50s and 60s artists. Maybe you know the Franklin Brothers or Rockin' Robin that played around here. We toured. And so I was with them and they were in New York. And Felix Cavallari was in the studio. And I got to meet him and I think one other member of the Young Rascals. And it's just funny to see somebody that you saw on TV as a kid, you know, to see him in the studio. So,
he's just so delightful and wonderful. So, you know, like you mentioned George Benson, and you worked with him, though, didn't you? Or
no, I didn't. But I'm really happy to say that I met him outside of a club which was closed in Chicago. It was done for the night. And it was just him walking there to see a friend by himself. And he was so generous and so unassuming. And I think you guys might know Henry Johnson or have heard of him. Fantastic.
Yeah.
He was so generous with his time. And we actually kind of met on the phone in 1979. And then we started hanging out in 1979. And he was showing me things on the guitar. We played together a couple times. So he's been my friend ever since. And it was very, very inspiring hearing Henry play and talking about George and Wes Montgomery. And of course, Henry was great friends with Billy Foster. So it was really a delight and a pleasure to meet Henry and Billy and to play with them. And Henry was really, you know, really great influence.
Right. I know Esther was involved with, I was emceeing the event a few years ago where they had a jazz fest and he was at that also. So
great guitar player and wonderful, wonderful person.
So we're just about 2 minutes left here. We gave you a chance to tell us about how people can find out about your music. I know this is going to be in October, so I know don't think you have your gigs into the fall yet, but tell us how people can find your music online, your website, and if they want to reach out and contact you.
Yes, they can go to billboris.com and send me a message, and I'll get it through my regular email. And my music is available to listen to on Spotify, and also it's on all the major platforms, I think, where they sell CDs, Amazon and everything else.
Excellent.
Right.
So the two CDs are Hold Back and Bright Moments.
And so if they want to see your event schedule, they should just go to your website.
Just go to my website. And they can also, there are videos on there of performances, and they can listen to the music. They can listen to different audio.
And of course, we heard you at September 20th, where you were with Billy Foster and part of that whole celebration of his life event at IUN in September 20th. That he's bringing you as additional players to traditionally the Billy Foster trio. So that will be a real treat. Again, it's Bill Boris, and you can find him at billboris.com. Listen to all that. He is available if you want to contact him for music and everything. We appreciate you coming on Art of the Year and sharing your music journey and your music with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Esther. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Art of the Year listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
Hey, this is Bela Fleck, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Timothy McNamara to Art on the Air. Tim is an innovative musician and educator. He is versed in many instruments, piano, saxophone, flute, and the clarinet, but his main instrument is the tenor sax. He offers private instruction on all the mentioned instruments. With the Chicago Jazz Ensemble, he has traveled the world, and he's also had many opportunities to play with some of the jazz greats. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Tim. It's very, very nice meeting you.
Thank you. It's nice to meet you both, our listeners who are listening in.
Well, we actually are WVLP and also Lakeshore Public Media, which puts you on NPR. But you know what our listeners want to know is all about Tim and your background. I always say your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Tim.
Okay. Well, I have an older brother who's a guitar player, and I was playing basketball with some kids when I was 8, and a salesman from a local music store came around and said, would anyone like to take music lessons? And I ran home and told my mom, and she got me into piano lessons, which I started in third grade when I was 8. And then I joined band on a brass instrument because apparently I was asleep. When I got to high school, I said to the band director, I would like to play the tenor saxophone. And I always now, in retrospect, I feel like perhaps he didn't really like me. He said, ask that kid how to play it instead of him teaching me. So I did ask that kid. And I was, because my older brother was a rock and roll hippie guitar player, I learned some things that kind of gave me an edge, even though I was essentially a beginner. I was a good kid academically. I went to the University of Illinois to study electrical engineering, but I did not want to be in the corporate world. God bless them. I just wasn't for me. And I left school to the chagrin of my mother and father. And I was so blessed. I almost immediately fell into a mentorship, in a sense, with a man named Sinclair Greenwell Jr., whose name was Guido Sinclair. And he was a great jazz saxophone player who had a blues band. And we were all affiliated with this place in Urbana called Nature's Table. And Guido immediately let me play in the blues band, which I had done some of that. And I was learning more jazz tunes. And then we played a lot. Another person during that era, and Guido's story is a bit interesting because there was a man who was a retired pastor, Reverend Alexander, I don't know his first name. This is before there was actual rehab. It was his mission to get people who were into the hardcore old-fashioned jazz life, let's say, out of Chicago into Champaign-Urbana and to clean up their act. It didn't exactly take hold for Guido. But despite some of his difficulties with substances, he was a great figure to be around. And I learned so much about so many areas of music. Then another fella came along through that pipeline his birth name was Donald Garrett. He later added Raphael. So sometimes he's known as Raphael Donald Garrett. He actually plays on John Coltrane's 1965 recording Ohm, and he actually was a great clarinetist and a protege of Wilbur Ware, the very famous bassist. So Raphael taught me a lot about how to make a good sound on the saxophone, and I had a very good friend down there, Kevin Kaiser, who was very helpful to me. And then I
so is that, are you the Tim McNamara on the Champaign Underground Stories to Tell, but playing the harmonica?
No, do not play a harmonica, so that's not me.
Were you on any of those Champaign Underground productions?
I'm not familiar with that. During what era or time frame?
Like that would be 2000, so kind of not recent, but more recent than when you were in Champaign.
Yeah, I left there in 1989 because I got a gig and I left, which was my third, a husband and wife from Peoria, Eddie and Judy Howard, were working at, of all places, Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island. Their saxophone player needed to leave. They asked, would I like to come up there? I did. I worked steadily in the era when there were steadies. I had a steady with them for about 6 months. God bless them. They're still around. That man is one of the greatest singers I've ever heard, really. Rested, what a talent, and just the loveliest people. Anyway, the band leader on Mackinac Island was Detroit saxophone legend Larry Nozero, who people may not recognize by name, but he is the soprano soloist on Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. The intro, that's him. So when Eddie and Judy let me go, because they had to, I called Larry, and he asked me, can I play baritone sax and clarinet? And I said yes. And then when I got up there, and I did get a loan from my mom to buy a baritone, he pretty much immediately said, you haven't played these instruments before. And I said, Larry, that's true. I very much wanted to be in the band up here with you. And he liked me, and it was a great experience. There were a lot of older musicians who, in the old-fashioned sense, would school you in ways that are not considered educationally sound now. They would there was a drummer who was a fantastic drummer. He would play the ride cymbal pattern behind me in the dining room, and he would moan, oh, and he would say, man, you got to learn about rhythm. You got to learn how to swing. So thank God for all these people in my life. And then that period ended. I came back to Chicago. I got an apartment. I went back to school at DePaul. I got a degree in music through Bob Lark, who now runs the program at Valparaiso, who was it's been a series of sublime blessings in my life, I have to be honest with you, because I don't think I came into this world with a lot of precocious musical talent, but I was extremely stubborn and hard-headed, and I kept at it, and hopefully I've made some progress. And the mentorships, yes.
So I just wanted a little clarification on that, those first piano things. So in the household, was there already a piano when you decided to take piano?
No, there wasn't. I had to go to the house across the street into their basement, which we didn't have a basement. Where I grew up was about 2 miles south of Midway, and they didn't build homes there because it had a very low water table or high water table. I don't know. I'm not a geologist, but whatever the phrase is, it was prone to flooding. Let's be succinct. So I had this was a long time ago. They gave my mom, the school gave me a cardboard keyboard, but then I went to the piano that was in the basement of the house across the street. I didn't really care for that. Then my mom and dad were very supportive. They bought a piano, although my dad did not enjoy me practicing the piano when he came home from his hard commute at work. So, that's how I started on the piano. And the piano, I kind of came back to. But I studied it for a long time. I had a very good teacher, an elderly German woman who lived in Oak Lawn, Illinois, named Helen Allworm, who I had approached her about my interest in jazz, which was nascent at that time, only just beginning. And all she could say about jazz was that they all had basically a bad technique regarding their hands, which is a very superficial thing. And frankly, not really true, because there's plenty of jazz pianists that are very well-versed and came up in a very schooled kind of way. So I didn't really learn much about improv for her. The improv thing I started to understand and learn more about, which is really an oral, A-U-R-A-L kind of way that you need to learn. And that started to happen for me amongst my friends in Urbana, who told me, you need to listen to this, you need to listen to that, especially Guido Sinclair, that's what we did. We drove around in his van doing God knows what, listening to Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, Thelonious Monk, that kind of thing. Please, I'm going on and on. Ask me another question.
Oh, no, that's great. So how did you go from piano to landing to saxophone? I assume did you start on the alto sax? Or
No, that happened in high school.
Okay.
I after marching band ended, I told Mr. McCutcheon at Revis High School, I would like to play the tenor saxophone. And as I mentioned earlier, he said, ask that kid how to play it. And so I did. But I basically, because I knew the piano, which was very helpful. I sort of taught myself how to play. And then later in Urbana, I did have some formal instruction at various points, also on flute through the university a little bit. But then I left the school. And then I got a lot more formal instruction on saxophone at DePaul,
right,
which I'm already now 27, 28 years old. Mm-hmm. But I already was a working musician in a sense.
Right. That's what I was wondering. So when did all of that start happening? When did you start doing? Because I imagine you're doing even in high school, probably. Were you playing out?
A little bit. Some friends of mine, we had a little rock band. And we played, and our high school had a jazz band. And in those days, I don't think it's the same now, but jazz in the late 70s and early 80s, there were so many big jazz festivals in the Chicago area that it was, we were immersed in it a lot. And when I was in high school, I tried out for the baseball team. And then I said to the coach, well, I have jazz band rehearsal. And he said, what do you want to be in? You want to do baseball or you want to do jazz band? And I said, I want to do jazz band. I'll see you later. And I usually wasn't that way with adults, but it was clear to me that that's what I love. And regarding my origin thing, my mom and dad liked all kinds of music, but they didn't really listen to a lot of music actively. It was generally WBBM news radio. I guess we had to know the stock market and the weather kind of thing. So I started going to the neighboring town, had a very good public library. And the first record I checked out was Sonny Rollins' Saxophone Colossus. And probably the second record I got was Horace Silver's Finger Poppin'. And those are still two of my favorite recordings. Mm-hmm. I think the third one was Giant Steps by John Coltrane. And I had done enough reading to know that these were,
the Giants.
Yeah,
the Giants.
Standard.
That's right, the standard bearers.
The gold standard.
Yes, and then in my association with Guido, I began to really get immersed in the music of Charlie Parker, who I still admire as probably the greatest saxophone player of all time. I think most of us who do this feel that he's, as tragic as his story is, his ability in music and his innovations, everyone has copied.
Right.
Frankly, emulated him.
So, Tim, what was your leap then into professional, designating yourself as being a professional musician? And
that happened in the late 80s. I left school. I was playing gigs, but, we were not getting, we were kind of playing for the door. So I worked at the bar that we played at, which was called Nature's Table. It's no longer there. And I started to work more in Champaign or Urbana and also, mid-central Illinois places like Bloomington and Springfield, et cetera, driving around. And then when the couple called me to play at Grand Hotel, then I was a full-time musician. When I moved back to Chicago, though, after that period ended, this is about 1992, it seemed like going back to school was a good idea because I wasn't really working that much. And I was kind of, even though I wasn't exactly the youngest person on the scene, I felt like it would be a good idea. And the opportunity came up actually on a Blues Brothers gig. I met a guy who taught at DePaul and he said, you can take lessons with me if you play Barry in the big band. And since I had gotten some experience on baritone saxophone, I sometimes worked as a Barry sax player. That's how I got into school at DePaul, thanks to Bob Lark.
When did flute come into your life?
I started playing the flute when I was 18 in Urbana. I took lessons from a woman who I think she's still active as a teacher and player in the Cleveland area. Her name at that time was Ellen Finch. I think she's subsequently married, and I don't recall what her new name is. But she was my first flute teacher, and then I continued studies on flute and clarinet at DePaul, which had, of course, at that time, the great Larry Combs, but you had to be a grad student in clarinet to study with him. But the other, the grad students were all fantastic clarinet teachers, so I studied a lot with them, and I continued flute there. I did just pretty much all I did was play in the bands. I had all knocked out all my other educational requirements. So it was all, it was 2 years of music with the thought that I would continue on and get my master's degree, which I very unwisely decided against in 1996.
Sure. Real quick, I want to play, and we can't play the whole thing, but it's Cantaloupe Island. I guess it was at Andy's. This is recorded live, so it's not like a studio recording. Tell us, we'll just listen to 30 seconds of that.
Okay, so this is my dear friend Frank Russell. He had a band playing there. This would have been, I think, right after the pandemic ended, so late 21 or early 2022. And Billy Foster, the legendary pianist from Gary, who we'll be playing with before this is aired, he was on, he's on piano. Charles Rick Heath, who was the last drummer to play with Ramsey Lewis, and Frank on drums. And this is recorded on a Tascam mini recorder. So it's, yeah.
Not the case, okay, here it is, Cantaloupe Island, and this was recorded at Andy's. That's our guest today, Tim McNamara on Cantaloupe Island. Andy's, and there's just a quick little clip to give an example of exactly how he sounds when he's doing his tenor sax.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
And there's a lot of video. Just look up Tim McNamara sax and you'll find a lot of video.
Thank you, Esther. I did create, I'm not the most technologically savvy person, but I finally created a YouTube channel. And I made a website for myself for ostensibly for teaching lessons here in my apartment. But I thought it would serve two purposes and get some students out of it. So it's my teaching website, but with links to audio samples as well.
And so yes. It, from the teaching website, I learned that you do teach very, very beginners to experienced. Is that still what you're doing?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if somebody is already playing concertos on the piano, they wouldn't seek me out because they would already be well past me. But that doesn't happen very often. I have somebody who's just entered fourth grade, and then my eldest student, I also teach at Oakton College in Illinois, in Des Plaines, Illinois, and my oldest student, I think, is 79 on the saxophone.
So when you're teaching a woodwind like that, now do you also teach piano? Well, that's a second question, but how do you start teaching them the technique? Do you start them on an alto sax, probably, I would imagine, before the, or how does that work? What's the process?
Well, it depends. Kids generally, student-age children start on alto sax for the most part, because that's usually what the school requires. The adults that I teach are already own a saxophone, and they're coming to me to learn how to play the tenor. And generally, they're coming to me to try to improve or learn something about jazz, which I hopefully can help them with.
Right. And of course, one thing I discovered, because my daughter is a saxophone player, is how important the choice of your reed is, depending on things, you know, depending on what you're playing, whether you're playing jazz. In fact, she had a reed she called Chippy that had a slight chip in it, and she used it for jazz because it had a different sound than like playing in a band. But what other things do you teach them, like in terms of technique? Yeah, I'm sure there's like book exercises, but do you also teach them the improvisational techniques?
I do. It depends on the level that the student's at. So a person who wants to play jazz at any kind of level has to have somewhat of a formal training on being able to play their instrument properly. So we go through all of that. First of all, how to breathe, not use a reed named Chippy is what I would say generally. And breathing, relaxing, learning your scales. We then, for the people that are interested in jazz, we do learn chords and scales. And we there's a, now a plethora of backing tracks on YouTube where somebody can pretty much find any song that they like and play right, you know, learn to play the song with it. And I also encourage them to play and try to do solos by ear and also by writing them out, which we call transcription or transcribing.
Do you also plug them into organized bands? Like you might have these individual students, but maybe encourage them to go into different areas like that?
Yes, that's how nice, how prescient that you asked me that. I have a student who started on the saxophone in June, but she's so thrilled. I think she had some overbearing teachers in her early, so she was very turned off. She's now in our Oakton Jazz Band in a community college. The jazz band is open to the community. It's even though community has been dropped from Oakton College, but it's technically still a community college. And she constantly is emailing me about how thrilled she is, how much fun it is. And everybody's, so yes, I try to get people in ensembles. That's very critical to play in a group, a small group or a large, big, these are big bands.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have about a minute and a half left. We want to give you a chance to tell, have people, your website, how people can reach out to you and anything that you got coming up in the fall that people can hear you in person.
Well, I'm a monthly guest at 18th Street Brewery, the one in Gary, not the one in Hammond, the one in Gary, the original location. The owner, Virgil Lincoln, so far likes my playing, and we're trying to get people to the Miller Beach area, which seems to be really thriving or coming back to a certain extent. So I'll be playing there. Well, this will be past the time, but I would imagine I'll play there again in October. And then I've got some performances coming up with Mr. Foster, and I freelance. I marched in the Independence of India parade on Sunday morning playing Dixieland music,
in Valparaiso or?
No, on the northwest side of Chicago in the Indian area, the Hindi. Well, it's such a, there's so many ethnicities within that. It was kind of ironic that we're playing NOLA jazz, but I try to channel at least my understanding of Carnatic music, and I got a thumbs up from a guy, a Hindi guy, so I was very thrilled for that, actually, frankly.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art on the Air. That's Timothy McNamara, jazz saxophonist, also woodwinds of other kinds like flautist and everything. And flute. You can hear him around, flute, all the kind of things. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air and sharing your music journey.
Thank you, Larry and Esther, for having me. It was really fun. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell it to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.